many of us grew up with of Jesus, which I did, was an artist that we might not even know his name, but his name is Heinrich Hoffmann. Has anybody ever heard of Heinrich Hoffmann? German artist, 19th century. Okay, you haven't heard of him now, but I bet you have seen this picture. Jesus kneeling on a rock in Gethsemane with his fingers like this and a light coming down in his face. Yeah. And I remember as a child, I was always playing with my hands, feeling if I could get all of my fingers like that. Okay, this was Heinrich Hoffmann. He also painted Jesus in the temple. He painted many other pictures of Jesus. And they were the most common pictures, I think, hanging in our Sunday school walls. And then he really had an American painter who was somewhat a disciple or in the same spirit, Werner Salmon. Jesus knocking on the door. And the most famous, the face of Jesus, you know, and if you really look closely at that picture, it has a secret chalice hidden in the painting.
In Salmon's painting of Jesus, he made him such a handsome face, beautiful face.
Yeah, now the interesting is that Heinrich Hoffmann came out of the Germany of the Industrial Revolution, painted a picture of Jesus that would be comfortable for the factory owners and not the factory workers. If you ever looked at those pictures, this is never the Jesus in the factory. This is a very clean Jesus. And the masses of people really lost to the church at that time of the Industrial Revolution. And a Jesus was presented that was really the kind and clean Jesus. It was very different than the Jesus that would be in the factories. Do you follow me?
Yeah. What I'm,
and so we've grown up with certain images like this of Jesus. The cautious search for the historical Jesus is to say, not what are the images we grew up of Jesus or have been presented over the 2,000 years, but is there a cautious way, knowing we can never really do this perfectly, but is there a way that we can really begin to discover what the actual Jesus of history was like who walked on the dusty roads of Palestine as a historical figure in Jewish history? And that's what this book does. And one reason I recommend this book and one reason I've enjoyed this book is written by a man of Marcus Borg, who is a man of faith, who goes in this search for the historical Jesus as a believer in Jesus as Lord. And you'll notice that especially on the last chapter when he struggles with what it means to be a follower of Jesus in our day. So that's the second book I've recommended is called The Shadow of the Galilean, which is a narrative biblical studies. It's the telling of a story of a man at the time of Jesus, and it gets to the same question of the historical Jesus in the form of a short novel, which again is it's interesting book, and it's $9.95. Okay, we began our first session, remember, of really looking at Jesus as a man in a two-dimensional world, meaning a world of people, very similar to many indigenous people in our world today that actually believe in very sincerely in a two-dimensional world. The physical world around us, but equal and greater reality, the spirit world that is beyond and yet infuses the material world, the world of God. And Jesus was societies have unique people who become doorways into that spirit world. And in Jesus' society, he is one of those. We even with kind of boldness call Jesus a shaman of his day, of ancient Jewish two-dimensional society. The second time we looked at the social setting at the time of Jesus and how the Roman occupation and especially the heavy Roman taxation system had devastated Jewish society. Jesus came at a time of crisis, when a taxation system had really shattered the society apart, and the response of Jewish leaders was really to intensify what Marcus Borg calls a politics of purity. That in this crisis, above all, we must be the pure people, because the image of God is one who demands absolute purity. What this did was draw a line among people, the few above that line who were the pure people, and then under the line, all of the rejects, and then the consciousness of those people under the line of being unworthy, unfit, unloved by God, and having little or no dignity in that society. Then the third, we looked at Jesus who came with a alternative consciousness, an alternative way of seeing things. Because of his movement into the spirit world, he had found there both in the spirit world and in his tradition of studying the Old Testament scriptures, discovered that God, at the heart of God, is compassion, which in its the word in its deepest meaning means womb-likeness. This is the God of Jesus. And he goes into a society that is built around a different consciousness of God, a consciousness that God is the God who sits in heaven demanding absolute purity and rejecting anyone who falls below the line of absolute purity. And purity was based on the conventional wisdom of popular ideas, along with what are called the purity codes in the Torah. The Torah meaning Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Jesus went to the same Bible and saw the center of that Bible being the Exodus story of a God who burns with love and passion for people who are in need, not because they are good or pure, but because they are oppressed and they are in need. So Jesus now comes into the society with a new consciousness. We close by really showing the four kind of distinctions in that society. We looked at it in so many different ways that if anybody was trying to outline it, your outline will be a problem. And then I would just suggest reading the book. Okay, but the four different groupings of people. Now, I want to list those four, and I've lost them in my. So I'll try to remember them. It was the distinction, of course, between the righteous and the unrighteous. Remember, the unrighteous was not only the ones we're familiar with, like the tax collectors, the traitors to Jewish society, also the prostitutes, but in the midst of that crisis, they were also those who were called the non-observants, who in the midst of the heavy Roman taxation were not able to pay their tithe, and therefore they were considered lawbreakers. They were called sinners, and when Jesus was criticized with eating with tax collectors and sinners, the category sinners at least in part included those people who were not paying their tithe, so they could keep their little farms together. And remember, the greatest way for righteous people who were above the line to distinguish themselves from unrighteous people was by the withholding of meal. You would never eat with an unrighteous person. And then we had men and women, and we had rich. Rich were considered blessed by God because of their righteousness. the poor were considered cursed by God because of their unrighteousness. And then we had the Jew and the Gentile. And along with the Gentiles would then include the Samaritans. And how in the politics of compassion, or the social way of living together based on the compassion of God, Jesus really broke each one of these, is what Marcus Borg calls the way of conventional wisdom. Before we move on now today, I'm getting frightened. This will be a 40-minute introduction. Here. But before we move on, I'd like to say one word here about the danger of anti-Semitism. You know, to look at this study as saying, well, Jesus is totally criticizing Judaism, and then if we allow that to feed into the anti-Semitism that is the background that our culture has, we can say, well, this is great. Jesus is really getting at the Jews. And always a reminder that, I mean, how many times do we have to say it? Jesus is a faithful Jew. And I think Marcus Borg is the most helpful when we say, when he says that Jesus is not here walking the dusty paths of Palestine trying to start a new religion. But rather Jesus is presenting a new way for Judaism, the way of compassion over the way of purity codes. And Jesus, therefore, we could say, would come to Christianity and say, I want to bring a Christianity of compassion rather than purity rules. I think that needs to be said because of the danger here of a study like this of thinking Jesus is attacking Judaism in order to start a new religion. I made just a few more. I have a page here called Notes, or Little Things to Say at the beginning of tonight's class. Just a reminder of, I look back over notes, and these were kind of interesting things I forgot. The greatest offense of Jesus in eating with people called sinners, or tax collectors, was not only that he ate with them, but the indication in the Gospels is that he ate with them in festive meal. And there are really two different ways of eating in Bible times, which we have somewhat. One was kind of the ordinary meal, you know, where you eat on a typical Tuesday, and then you come back on a typical Wednesday and eat. And then once in a great while was the great festive meal, and the difference was the festive meal was reclined on pillows. And you wouldn't have an ordinary meal during the week reclined on pillows. And there's the indication in the gospel that Jesus shared festive meal. I mean, it's like saying it would have been offensive enough, Jesus, if it would have been an ordinary meal. But you're on pillows. Okay, another is just, again, to repeat under the men-women distinction, is to kind of drive this one home, is that in popular Jewish society at the time of Jesus, women were never to learn the scriptures of the Torah or be students. And this isn't that recent. We've known families in our cultures where the men are encouraged to go to school and the women aren't. But in that time, it was very definite. In fact, a popular idea was that it would be better to burn the Torah than to teach it to a woman. And just with that background, think of Jesus sitting in the home of Mary and Martha, and Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus learning. Jesus is establishing synagogue school in the home of women. Now, this is just one where Jesus is countering the conventional wisdom. Now, one thing to add here is a reminder that Jesus did not come on the scene of the conventional wisdom of Palestine and the Jewish people and say, I think I'll be a liberal. Okay. Think of the difference between, or I think I'll side with kind of the more liberal people in the society. But rather, Jesus came as one who had been in the spirit world and there discovered the God of compassion and just came teaching in the society what he understood as the God of compassion. Now, tonight we are going to look at the role of Jesus as prophet. During our study, we have shown how Jesus really fit into four rather traditional ways of being a teacher, leader, spirit type in that society. One was you were a charismatic, spirit-filled leader that healed the sick and brought the power of the other side in the midst of the world of sickness and, as they understood it, demon possession. You came into that society with the power of the other world, the world of God's Spirit. First characteristic. Secondly, a sage, a teacher of wisdom. And we looked at how Jesus did that in the telling of parables. The third, a renewal movement leader, a revitalization movement leader, one who comes to rebuild Jewish society according to a vision of how Jewish society was and ought to be. And now the fourth we'll look at now is Jesus comes as prophet. Now, most of you have heard this, the difference between the kind of modern understanding of the word prophet as one who has a crystal ball and kind of predict the future. But rather in Jewish times, in the times of Israel, a prophet is one who proclaims the word of God in a society for that society and for the renewal of that society. Jesus comes in now with the consciousness of a prophet. Now, two ways that Jesus comes as prophet, and Marcus Borg's outlines kind of start with two and then they enlarge into four, so don't take notes. Okay. But one, radical criticism of culture in the name of God. You know, the word of a prophet is not, well, I kind of had this opinion. But of a prophet is one who speaks with that authority, thus says the Lord. And then secondly, because of that, it's a voice of an alternative consciousness. Now, in the times of Israel, and Jesus follows this pattern, this would be true of the Isaiah, the Jeremiah, the Amos, the Hosea. A prophet comes with a threefold pattern. One is an indictment. You people have violated the covenant of God. Secondly, a threat of the kind of destruction that will come upon you because you are violating the covenant. And then third is a call to change and be saved. Now, this doesn't sound like the sweet Jesus with children sitting on his lap, which is a beautiful story in the Bible, but sometimes it makes us forget that Jesus comes with the power of the prophet and in the tradition of the prophets. And because of this, he shattered an enculturated religion. He was unpopular. He saw things differently. And he felt compassion, the compassion of God for the victims in the society, and was concerned about the whole shape of the human society. Now, I want to follow these three characteristics of a prophet and how Jesus did them. First, the indictment. Remember the teaching of the stories of Jesus that really made the leaders angry, calling them unfruitful fig trees, calling them blind guides, telling them they are following the externals and neglecting justice and the love of God. And in a way, Jesus wasn't calling them bad people. He was just very critical of their way of organizing things. Do you get the difference? And he wasn't going around saying, you rich people, you're bad people. But the way of life that they were living and proclaiming based on their image of what God is like. Jesus came with a severe indictment. And then secondly, the threat was very political. If you go back and read the Gospels, the threat is Jerusalem and the temple will be destroyed. Now this is in the tradition of Jeremiah or Amos, Hosea. Jerusalem and the temple will be destroyed. This was not comfortable preaching. And the encouragement of people is when it happens, flee to the mountains. Get out while you can still save yourselves. And a lot of the passages that we have interpreted as kind of end time passages are really Jesus talking about the coming destruction of Jerusalem by the Roman armies. Because the people, as we mentioned, I think our second class, had chosen the way of violence against the Roman occupation, and the destruction was coming. This is just some interesting historical trivia, but the time of the early church, the Jerusalem Christians remembered the teaching of Jesus, when these times come, flee to the mountains. And the early Jewish Christian community did get out of Jerusalem before the Roman army surrounded it. And they fled to the mountains and became a small kind of ingrown community that eventually went out of existence. But they did remember the words of Jesus, when the judgment comes, flee to the mountains. And thirdly, Jesus in the midst of this, the call to repent and change your ways and learn and be converted, to die and be raised to life centered in the God of compassion. And it was a call of Jesus, not for what we as North Americans all often interpret Jesus as concerned only about individual salvation of individual souls, but it was a call of Jesus for national salvation. Now, my next note is to turn to page 31 in this area. Okay. Jesus' message and movement, a call to a new way of life. And still, even in Jerusalem now, it is a call to a way of joy. It is a presentation of two pathways before the people, the broad way of conventional wisdom leading to destruction, the narrow way, the alternative way, which is a way of life. We all sang these distinctions when we were in Sunday school. The wise man built his house upon the rock. The wise man built. Anybody know that? Mm-hmm. Should we sing it? The wise man built his house upon the rock. The wise man built his house upon the rock. The wise man built his house upon the rock, and the rains came tumbling down. The rains came down and the floods came up. The rains came down and the floods came up. The rains came down and the floods came up. and the house on the rock stood firm. We know the other verse is a foolish man and that house goes kaplunk. Remember? I never understood when I learned that song that Jesus was talking about the politics of the nation. The wise man who builds his house on the rock, the alternative consciousness of a God who comes and calls God's people to live a society and a politics of compassion, the way of wisdom, over against the foolish man building his house upon the sand, making these distinctions in society to tear society apart, a society now at enmity with each other, and the good people judging the rich people, cutting themselves off, and then all of the people intent on taking up arms against the Romans in acts of violence. This is the couplet. So, new interpretation of the song. But we sang these songs to remember the teaching of Jesus is the broad way that leads to destruction and the narrow way that leads to life. And I remember as a child had a chalk talk on this, and it was very clear. The one was where all the bad people were on their way down to life after death in hell. And that was always the big superhighway with all of them people on it. Remember? Did anybody else? And this really narrow way going up to this little mansion up in the sky. Was I the only one that saw this picture?
Okay. How many rooms in the mansion?
Yes. Yeah. We put these things as life after death, you know, in the the realization when you're in touch with the Jesus of history, that Jesus is talking about the broad way of the nation that will lead to destruction, and the narrow way of his wisdom and his alternative consciousness that will lead to life for this nation. Now, let's move to Jesus and his journey to the cross to die on the cross in Jerusalem. Now, a consciousness I've had to work on in my own mind is that God is sitting up in heaven and saying, I must get this Jesus sacrificed so he will atone for the sins of the world. So you have God kind of manipulating things. Even if Jesus didn't do anything serious enough to get himself in trouble, it was basically a mistake engineered by God so Jesus would die on the cross as the atonement for sin. And I want to say when we look at the historical Jesus, we need to go back behind all of these images and all of these questions and simply ask historically, you know, why did the Romans kill this man, execute him as a political threat? Or was it just a mistake and God was kind of engineering the sacrifice for the sins of the world? Now, I started this by saying I'd be very cautious to share my faith in Jesus during the class because I wanted to focus on, you know, more of a struggle to try to understand the historical Jesus. But what I would add here, I have a deep, in my own life, a deep mystical sense that I cannot explain or understand that Jesus' death on the cross and the resurrection and all affects my reconciliation and our reconciliation with God. But I don't want to use that deep mystical belief to somehow take me away from asking the very political questions of why Jesus was crucified. Are you following? Okay, first, Jesus made a very intentional decision to go to Jerusalem. That's obvious in the Gospels. And if we understand the prophetic mind, if you are going to change a society and call a society to change, it is necessary for the prophet to go to the center of power in that society. the center of its life, the center of its thought molding of establishment. You know, if you had a deep sense and calling to really affect a change in America, would you go to Wakefield, Nebraska, or Washington, D.C.? I say Wakefield, it's my mother's hometown. Because there he delivered, "I have a dream." And there he told his dream. And I think it's a way to begin to get a consciousness of what Jesus was about now, moving to Jerusalem. And moving into Jerusalem as a prophet, he did what prophets do, and that is do visual, symbolic signs of what they are all about. There were two ways for a society changer to move into Jerusalem. One was on a horse, and one was on a donkey. And what would each of those symbolize? Anybody remember?
White horse would have been there. A horse, you know, was power. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be the military conquer, you know, calling the people to military battle. And it was a common symbol that when a king rode into a city, riding on a donkey was a sign that I come completely and totally, and please trust me in peace. So Jesus, by this act, sets himself up as a reminder that he comes to change society, but he has a greater power to change society than the way of violence, and it is a way of God's compassion and mercy and love and peace. And then the great prophetic act of then moving into the temple. Now here is the center of the cult of purity. You remember from the Bible study this morning, which was, several said this was a real insight to them, that the priest was not being indifferent, but the priest was being good according to the politics and the ethos of purity, right? He was doing what he had to do. And now Jesus goes to the very center of that cult of purity, the temple. And look what he says as he drives the money changers out of the temple and causes a tremendous uproar. This is to be a house of prayer for all nations. Therefore, cutting what the temple really stood for as that place where pure Jewish people go on the inside to announce their purity and Gentiles stay out, even had a place for them called the Court of the Gentiles. And Jesus announces this is to be a house of prayer for all nations. Then during the last days in Jerusalem, the conflict during that day, those days intensifies as a prophet speaks to those who are leading the people in the pathway of destruction. And so the death of Jesus comes. And the death of Jesus comes as a result of the decision of the Roman Empire. I think especially in John's Gospel, because of the tension in John's church, which most likely was in Ephesus, which is now in modern-day Turkey, where there's a tremendous strife against Orthodox Jews, that the Jewish implication in the death of Jesus was exaggerated. And just politically, this was a Roman act of execution that was probably conducted in close collaboration with a small circle of Jewish leaders who had a life of collaborating with the Roman government. And then to ask the question, why? And I think if you've gone through these three lessons now, and if I've done somewhat of a way of explaining what Jesus was about, in, or at least a beginning, or have tried, that I don't really have to say much more to know why Jesus is on his way to death. Do you follow? Let me just share the three that Marcus Borg especially brings out. Number one, Jesus is a public figure with a following. Now, powers are never threatened by little individual spiritual people that are off in their little corner praying. It is spirit people who have followings. I heard an example of this. It's very close to my family, but my brother lost his job as a high school teacher during the Vietnam War for taking a stand against the Vietnam War. And his danger was, he was a young high school teacher right out of college in those days, and just had a following of students who, all of the students who had problems with the Vietnam War kind of followed my brother, the art teacher, which I suppose are always a little suspect. Anyway, followed him around the school, you know. And he had his immature ways too then, which have all changed by now. But when we were talking about the other day, it was the threat of the following. And Jesus had a following. In other words, this is an alternative political, and by political I mean way of people existing together. An alternative that stands over and against the conventional wisdom way of people relating to each other socially and politically. Third, and I think this is the most important, why did these Jewish leaders collaborate with the Roman government so that Jesus would be crucified? It was because from there, and I say this with, we always say this with caution, I could be wrong, okay, and Marcus Borg could be wrong. But it makes sense to me. From their view as leaders in the consciousness of God, of a God of purity, Jesus was simply wrong. His blessing of the poor, his woe to people of wealth was wrong. His accepting of sinners and outcasts and non-observance was simply bad. His challenging of the conventional wisdom was simply wrong. And the fact that being this wrong and having a large following made him a person who had to be disposed of. He was a false prophet, a false teacher. His spirit was coming from Beelzebul, the devil, Satan, the prince of darkness, was informing Jesus, and people were following this person who was following Beelzebul, the prince of darkness. And therefore, Jesus must be disposed of. So these were not bad people, but they were doing their very best for the nation. So Marcus Borg says it's not who killed Jesus, but what killed Jesus. And it was the conventional wisdom, the dominant consciousness that had decided what was right and what was wrong, what was of God and what was of Satan, and the voice and the spirit of the alternate or of the conventional wisdom is what killed Jesus. And when Jesus was killed, it was basically, or I should say fundamentally, over for Jesus and the Jesus Renewal Movement. Because there was an understanding in popular piety that came out of the book of Leviticus. I'm sorry, Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy. And that verse says, "Cursed be anyone who hangs on a tree." And this meant that in the popular understanding, anyone who is crucified by the Roman way of execution was not only cursed by the Roman power, but also was cursed by God. The Jewish leaders had voted against Jesus, and now the crucifixion of Jesus to the people was the indication that God had joined their vote and voted no to Jesus. And therefore the disciples on the road to Emmaus would say, "We had hoped he would be the one." And the grammar of that simply means it's all over. Back to normal. Back to the way of violence. Back to the way of distinction between all of these groups. Back to the line where there are the good people up here and all the desperate and unworthy people down here. It's back to normal. The Jesus movement is over. And so the story ends. Now there's a fifth session tomorrow. We're going to talk about Easter. Okay. And I want to say there's, it's hard for me not to, is anybody leaving before? Okay. It's like, I want to, if you're leaving tomorrow, talk to me before you leave. It's like the old story of Dwight L. Moody, you know, who was going to preach judgment one night and grace the second night, and the Chicago fire happened. So I want to close there, and I hope I've given you a feeling of why it was not only very important, but also was righteous or right to crucify Jesus, and how the despair would have been complete, because popular wisdom said now even God had voted against the way of Jesus. Okay, let's, I'm interested in your...
do you think the Pharisees asked the Romans, "Look, would you crucify this guy instead of putting him to death some other way?"
We guess, you know, it was... You know, the Gospels indicate it was a Sanhedrin, which was a kind of a oppressed people occupied by another country, still have a certain form of power which the occupying forces can veto. You know, and the occupied Jewish people had this Sanhedrin council, which the Gospels indicate is the group that went to the Romans or collaborated with the Romans. And I'm not that good at this, but I understand different groups were represented on the Sanhedrin. Probably a strong representation of the Sadducees, which were the priestly aristocratic land owners, many who had taken advantage of the Roman taxation system to gain land and also a semblance of power. And also in my reading, if I remember, there were also high Pharisees. The company of the Pharisees were also represented on the Sanhedrin. These were the image makers and the idea molders that would have been there.
Well, what vested interest did the Romans have in Jesus? Was that a Jewish problem?
Okay, we would tend, I think, to think of it as a Jewish problem because we tend, and by tend I mean we all don't think this, and But we would tend to think that Jesus was purely a religious personality, teaching people how on an individual way they could repent and turn to God. And therefore, it's very hard for us to understand how Jesus could actually be a threat to the Roman government. One thing, the shadow of the Galilean in the story really traces how Jesus might have looked to the Roman government. They were extremely afraid of anyone who might upset the law and order of the oppressed people. And the Jewish people were the Roman thorn in the flesh, if I can use that. They were always on the brink of armed rebellion.
The Jews against the Romans.
Against the Romans.
Of all the empires.
Yeah, I mean, there were other peoples, you know. There were other peoples that were within the boundaries of the Roman Empire, but the Jewish people especially, it was, you know, the Romans would probably call it the Jewish problem. You know, how do we get these people to shape up and accept the benevolence that we as the Roman Empire bring to them? We are here for their good. You know, how can we finally convince them that we are here for their benevolence, that they can be part of the Roman peace? And instead, they want to constantly rebel against us. You can see how they would be very suspicious of the Jesus movement. Number one, because Jesus is a charismatic, spirit-filled leader. And number two, Jesus has followers. And sometime, read the Gospels, and the Romans had a tower that hovered over the temple. So they could part of their some sensitivity they had as rulers is that they would not go into the Jewish part of the temple. So instead, they built towers on the outside so they could look down into it. Now, this was a very paranoid oppressor and empire. So it wouldn't be hard for the image makers of the Jewish people, the leaders, to collaborate with them.
Wouldn't the zealots have been kind of looking for Jesus too, to maybe be leading? And of course, they were maintaining guerrilla warfare kind of a situation and all of them.
There's indication that all the way to the end they were hoping Jesus would make his move. And I think in Mark's gospel there's even some humor. The belief was that when the great leader comes into the temple, then he will give the word and the guerrilla armies that are ready. And where they organized in the temple, it was a perfect place for organizing because the Romans would not enter the temple courts. You know, the Romans, by being somewhat sensitive, actually were putting themselves in a little, taking away some of their advantage with the Jewish zealots or guerrilla armies. So I think it's in Mark's Gospel, or is it Luke's, where Jesus comes in to Jerusalem, into the temple courts, and then the mood is that everybody's waiting for him to make his signal for the guerrilla soldiers to come forward. Instead, he looks around and says, "My, aren't these big buildings?" And then he goes and stays with Mary and Martha.
Did the Romans have any god at all that they worshipped? Any deity?
Oh yeah, they had. You learned them in Latin class.
No,
Zeus, Jupiter. What were some of the others? And besides that. The whole other subject. I mean, it was a time in the Roman Empire when the old religion of the ancient Roman deities was kind of collapsing, and a lot of new religious ideas, especially from the East, were coming into the Rome. It was a time of real religious turmoil, but they had many, many gods. You know, some would like to see Jesus' carpenter shop Joseph having his own business as being a, you know, somewhat of a prominent member of the community, others would want to see them as being very poor. One indication is in the Christmas story, the sacrifice that Joseph and Mary bring to the temple at the time of the infancy of Jesus was a sacrifice of the poor. And we don't really know that. Luke really presents the people around Jesus and Mary as part of what sometimes are called the Anawim, or the righteous poor, people that maybe had even lost their land because of their dedication to keeping the Jewish law to its in its purity, paying their tithe and therefore losing their land. That's a possibility, but we don't know that much.
For a long time, I think we've always kind of felt that, or been, as you read, that there's, you know, the priests and the Sadducees and the Pharisees looked at Jesus as more of a threat to their own personal positions. Is what the author here saying, that that isn't really the situation so much as just a difference of opinion?
Most of the writers, and this is interesting, I think we grew up thinking of those Jewish leaders as bad people. You know, these were the greedy, crafty, kind of evil, and in our passion plays, we'd make sure that which actors played, you know, the Jewish leaders. I don't know names of actors, but you wouldn't pick Charlton Heston or something to play the high priest, maybe. But so we grew up with this, and the scholars that I've read, maybe some of you can help me, really paint these people in the most positive light, and that is from their religious understanding and their deep desire to preserve the nation as best they could. They were doing, in their consciousness, the right thing. Have any others studied this or looked in?
I'm sure that's inherent to any upheaval, the loss of self, the control, so I'm sure that's part of it too.
Part of it, you know, that they would, Jesus was certainly a threat to their, because if the Jesus idea caught on, I mean, I'm sure they heard everything he said, the greatest will be the least and the least will be the greatest. You know,
I mean, even today you look at our politicians who are all sincere, honest, trustworthy and loving, kind and clean people. They're also concerned that when their party fails, when their president isn't elected, they will suffer consequences too.
Yeah. I think scholarship recently has wanted to emphasize this, of their doing the best they could, because kind of an anti-Semitism has really painted them as the meanest, ugliest of villains. And I think what you're saying is, let's just think of them as ordinary politicians.
And makes them mean, ugly villains.
You know, I think they have a deep desire for the good of the nation, and it's all wrapped up in their, also the position they have and want to hold and maintain. I'm just guessing from the way human beings are.
It seems like it's significant to recognize that there's those same patterns in our society now in terms of religious people isolating themselves, in terms of the righteous are inside this building and the unrighteous are outside the building, and the kinds of ways that we define the law and we define people who don't obey the law. And we have our own moral code now that are often we put the unrighteous outside of that code, and that they would become very threatening to have a religious leader that said that that's not right.
Yeah.
That the same situation could occur right today, and is occurring in some situations.
Part of the encouragement is to read some of those powerful images of Jesus through the ages, you know, and one of them certainly is the if you never read the whole novel, read the one chapter in the Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky, of the Grand Inquisitor, Jesus coming back, and the kind of the same forces all taking place. Was there a hand?
Yeah, I think I appreciate the importance of not demonizing the Pharisees or the Jews in general in terms of the narrative of the passion of the Jesus story. On the other hand, to say that it was a difference of opinion and not to understand the socioeconomic power struggle at play here is to miss, I think, the real threat that Jesus mounted to the system. Mm-hmm. I mean, the religious power was political power and economic power, and that was in collaboration with an imperial power.
Right.
And those collaborators had a stake in stability as much as the Romans did.
Mm-hmm.
So, I really do appreciate your efforts to help us not just kind of line up with anti-Semitism that's a part of our tradition, but at the same time there was a real deep political economic threat mounted by the Jesus movement.
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful. Because a reminder, I think, is in our second class session of the losing of land by the small landowners, that many, many of the large landholders that took over that land and became the absentee landholders were what in the New Testament we meet as the Sadducee party. And these were the ones that really were up there on top collaborating with the Roman rulers. And therefore, it really was a rich-poor power distinction, wasn't it? And imagine the threat of Jesus to them when he came announcing the year of Jubilee. And, you know, the year of Jubilee wasn't just kind of a time for a national happy party. This was the time when the landowners would give all of the Nahalal back to the people. I think I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, was this a threat? If we have a word from El Salvador, is there any, I mean, are the large landowners ever threatened by new ways of thinking?
No, they never say.
They never say, I was mistaken. Yeah. But there are corollaries? And some would say, well, Jesus came with this joyful announcement of land reform, mm-hmm. and then we tend to say, well, it never happened. But one of the most powerful statements in both Zacchaeus, who is kind of a preview of the early Christian community, and the early Christian community is it did happen. But it happened in a surprise way. The rich were so excited about this new reality that it had come upon them that they gladly released. And the year of Jubilee did come. And instead of there being sad about it, those who entered into the new consciousness of Jesus joyfully released their land. Oh, this must have been a threat to those powers that held both the religious powers, they held the media powers, powers of ideas, setting the ideas, and also they held the economic wealth. And if there's one sense from looking at the historical Jesus, it wasn't an accident that he was crucified. He was a real threat. Yeah, thanks. That was...